The COVID-19 crisis has caused havoc for healthcare organizations in a number of ways. One area has been in hospital finances. Hospitals need to look ahead to prepare for even more drastic financial challenges. Welcome to Modern Practice. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva, and on this episode, we're going to talk about how organizations can carry out financial and operational strategies that help them deal with challenges they'll may be facing in the future. Helping me in this discussion are two of my colleagues from SG2. Brian, why don't you please introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Yes, thank you, Tom, and very much appreciate you having us on today. This is Brian Esser. As Tom mentioned, I work with SG2 on the intelligence team, where we really focus on helping health systems and physician practices think about what is coming down the pike related to healthcare delivery, strategy, and really all things at this point, COVID-related. The intelligence team at SG2 is future-focused. We have service line specialists that lead specific service line work. We also have enterprise-level folks like Ryota and myself who think broad, big-picture strategy. I've been with SG2 a little bit over a year and have a consulting background.
Thank you, Brian. Ryota, tell us about yourself and what you do.
Really great to be joining this conversation. As Brian mentioned, I'm part of the intelligence team at SG2 as well. I focus more on the orthopedics as well as spine service lines and collaborate with Brian in the payment and policy space, which is, you can imagine, top of mind with the COVID response now. So really looking forward to the discussion today.
Lucky to have both of you gentlemen join us today. Thank you. So Brian, let's start with you. So how significant is the financial pressures hospitals are facing? I mean, how long will it take to get back to what we used to know as normal?
Tom, that's the million-dollar question, or maybe even the billion-dollar question we're hearing from members. It's fascinating. A couple quick stats. So if you look at just OR volumes, which is really, obviously, as we all know, a lion's share of revenue generated by hospitals is geared in the OR, we're seeing declines year over year from 40 to 60%. And that was just late March. So, you know, it continues to go up in that just cut of elective surgeries mostly. So a lot of revenue being lost there. But in addition to that, Tom, the ambulatory side, everything outpatient, seeing 80, 90% reductions in volume. So massive, massive impact financially for the systems.
Wow. So, I mean, we're seeing these huge effects. I mean, I've certainly seen it in my practice where I'm only seeing patients virtually and I'm not really seeing all that many. Patients are just getting accustomed to it. So when we go back to, and I'm putting up quotes in my hands right now, what we call normal, is it kind of like flipping on a switch or is there a rate limiting factors to take into consideration here?
You know, first of all, when you think of the visual flipping the switch on, which I think that V-shaped recovery, and Ryota and I have been debating this quite a bit. Everyone's hoping for a V-shape. That would be the best case. But more as we go into the duration of time that we're under the COVID, we're thinking that this is more of a U-shaped or even maybe a W. And I'll let Ryota expand on that. So think about instead of a switch being flipped back on, this is more of a dimmer. We're gonna bring this on very slowly, it seems.
But I would imagine there's some key wildcard factors to consider here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as much as we want to think about it, the key one, Tom, as you probably obviously know, testing is going to be the most critical wild card. Our ability to test broad scale and then have active testing going on as we start to bring our patients who are very fearful of any healthcare setting, rightfully so, give them the confidence to come back in. But in addition to testing, there's a whole myriad of things from supplies beyond PPE, which will be one of the most critical supply deficiencies. But you're thinking about, you know, implants, devices, blood, plasma, anything in the OR that you might need is going to be under significant supply pressure moving forward because everyone is going to, A, want it now and probably want it at volumes that they had not had historically because they're trying to surge up their overall throughput. So supplies are going to be a big one. Workforce, again, very critical. We're seeing furloughs, layoffs across the systems, but the plan to come back and really push their volumes as much as possible will require workforce that has been unemployed potentially to be asked to do nights, weekend hours. Sure. And that's just going to be a challenging situation for everyone. And then lastly, just overall capacity. Do you have not only the ORs in your system to capture all this pent-up volume, but what about beds for these patients if they're on the inpatient side? What about your post-acute facilities? Are you coordinated well with them as we've seen a lot of hotspots of COVID in the post-acute setting as well? So there's a lot of different sort of rate limiters or factors that are going to prevent us from getting back to normal as quickly as we may want.
So I get it. I mean, there's supplies, which in some cases, if you're talking about procedural, are some of the things that we've been dealing with in the current crisis. Workforce, for sure, in the sense that you've had some people go furlough, are they willing to come back? And are they going to be available to do additional shifts? But you mentioned capacity. Is that the willingness of patients wanting to come back also part of that equation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, we track the idea of consumerism, just, you know, patient preference, how they engage with healthcare. And historically, you know, that's been based on cost, maybe access, but that is quickly being supplanted by almost, you know, I hate to say it, but fear or uncertainty of can I engage with healthcare? And they just don't know. There's a lot of mixed messages. And as you know, the physician community knows a lot more about how healthcare works and viruses and spread, but the general population just doesn't quite understand all that.
You know, Ryota, when you're dealing with what kind of discussion should be happening right now between hospital leaders, operations, physicians, to be prepared, what are those kind of discussions they should be having prior to even restarting business?
Excellent question. I think a lot of our members are working through that now. Certainly, I think what was just discussed in terms of all the bottlenecks and rate limiters in terms of being able to restart, reactivate, what does that look like? But also having some tough conversations around what does that new normal look like? Just trying to get back to where you have been budgeted for is increasingly looking like an unrealistic option. Hopefully that's the case for some people where they go back where they budgeted for. But speaking to when Brian mentioned that U-shape and W-shape recovery, U-shape really means that even after you get the okay to go ahead on restarting surgery, for that myriad of factors that Brian talked through, whether it's supply or demand constrained, the reactivation just takes a lot longer and you might not be able to get back to those volumes for a while. Now, W-shape one would be, in addition to those factors, thinking through what happens, we have that secondary postponements or tertiary, third ones. This is something that's becoming more and more realistic for a lot of markets, especially as we have maybe potentially regional impacts of COVID. So we have the national one more and more contained. Kind of thinking through related scenario planning for all of these, given the uncertainty, is critical. But I think every organization, if they have not already, should be rethinking how does this impact not just the short term, but also the long term vision for your organization.
So still a lot of uncertainty right now. We're trying to figure out what the new normal is. And I would imagine that's a new industry term. But what are some of the innovative ideas emerging right now to maximize capacity that you may have heard of?
For maximizing capacity, I think certainly the ASC and really outpatient shift is something that we're thinking may move 2 to 3 years faster than we had been expecting the industry to move. But there are issues moving to that space as well, specifically thinking through what is that facility capable of doing today. It's not just that you have the facility, but what's the equipment there? What's the staff like? And then a lot of the factors that may be limiting surgery recovery would also apply on the ASC setting, particularly for supplies, as well as kind of the testing issues we're still working through. How do you really keep track of which patients, which staff, not only are not infected, but potentially immune as well. But we're tracking that closely as well.
You know, it goes back to the testing issue that Brian just brought up. You know, Brian, during our April 15th WebEx on financial and operational impacts of COVID-19, Dr. Edward O'Brien from MUSC mentioned that the consideration of testing staff and patients 48 hours prior to elective procedures. Where does other areas of testing come into play here?
First off, as you said, Tom, that pre-op testing both patients and staff is going to be a new protocol, a new operational normal for us there. I think the other thing to think about testing is as your staff becomes more integrated here, you need to ensure that you don't want to lose OR surgical teams in their entirety. You know, if one patient go through with COVID, they expose the patient or the staff, and they're essentially out for 2 weeks and you lose that entire team and your volumes just don't go down again. So it's really that ongoing work there. And then really getting further into the community as testing becomes more readily available, contact tracing and working with the public health officials and thinking outside the box. How do you use your network, you know, your CINs, or maybe ACOs to bring in public health, other governmental or county level agencies to really coordinate the testing in a broad scale? That's going to be where we really get ahead and can really see our operations return to as normal as possible.
So it's actually looking not only just within our own organizations, but looking for state, local, and even federal guidance, hopefully even through the CDC.
Yeah.
I can definitely see that. So how will payer mix change impacting schedules, say even pre-authorizations or just overall reimbursement?
this is one of the sad sides of the COVID crisis as well. You know, as we're recording today, another 5 million claims for unemployment just went in. So we're upwards of 20 million over the past several weeks. And that's right. Just going to have a massive impact on payer mix, especially at the health system level, as they start to see the degradation of commercial payers into either uninsured, Medicaid, the state exchanges. And with that comes an erosion of reimbursement as well.
Right.
You know, obviously COBRA is going to be there and other unemployment type benefits, but those tend to be fairly expensive for the patients and long-term probably not sustainable. And obviously there's governmental bailouts and support that can help that. But we would expect that you're going to see a fairly healthy shift to reimbursement side from commercial to something else that's lower pay. So just knowing that, as you said, Tom, you know, pre-auth, things like that, that patients may have been ready 2 weeks ago, but now they have a new insurer or no insurance. What does that mean? You know, there's things that we need to consider there. And then longevity and how do you recoup your financials at the global level for a system? It's just going to draw that timeline out. So even if we see this volume, if the reimbursement is lower, you're just not getting back to the financial health you once were. And that impacts everything from just reimbursement, ability to manage your expenses, workforce, supply, et cetera, but also your bonds. Can you continue to repay those in an effective manner at the system level? There's a lot of reverberations around that topic.
So it's not only on what type of payers you're going to be coverage on, and we can possibly expect that there's going to be less commercial payers, but also in reference to what the financial markets may have a direct impacting in reference to bonds to our hospitals as well.
Yeah.
I get that. Yeah. I get that. Ryoga, I've mentioned before that I'm seeing uncertainty among my patients and particularly their willingness to come back to the practice or the offices. Now, is this a phenomenon we're seeing throughout the country, or do you think that are there ways that we can actually mitigate having our patients feel comfortable to coming back?
Now, that's an excellent question. It's really an interesting situation where we've almost, as an industry, communicated to patients that hospitals are not safe places to go during this COVID pandemic. So it's not going to be as easy as switching to flip switch and going, oh, now it's a safe environment, you should come. I don't think we're going to be able to convince many people of that.
Right.
So first, definitely thinking through what it means to provide high quality and safe care for your patients, but then how do you communicate that out? Of course, having your physician buy in to that process, being part of that is critical, but also for those organizations that have patient and family advocates, those might be really great kind of groups for you to be engaged in currently to understand where their concerns are and how do you address it. Really thinking through what's that right terminology, but also who are the right stakeholders that you need to address your concerns, not just their patients, but also their family members as well.
So what I'm hearing here is that patient and family engagement are going to be key components that were previously thought of just being nice to have to actually being key strategic factors.
Yeah, Tom, I would say that becomes a new competitive advantage. Whichever system a physician group can earn that trust back quickest will win in this environment.
Gentlemen, I'm curious also, when you're looking at the new normal, I think that when it comes to virtual care, many of my patients have actually become very accustomed. And I've stated this on a previous podcast where I actually believe that at least 50% of my chronic care visits can easily be done virtual care. I was curious if you had any thoughts behind that as a way of ramping up.
Yeah, I'll throw some ideas out, but Ryota has a lot of experience here as well. Virtual care, as you've heard, Tom, we're at this inflection point, right? And, you know, all of a sudden, everything's going to be virtual, which, you know, I don't think we're going to go 100% all in, but as you're seeing in your patient mix, you know, there's a lot of things you could do virtual. And I think there was roadblocks before, either payment related, maybe political, maybe we just didn't want to get there, but this will truly push us into that new realm. But we think virtual is going to really help the systems at least maintain their patient bases to a degree during the crisis. And it's really going to represent a new revenue stream, a margin stream for these systems post-crisis. And again, those that have invested in this infrastructure prior to COVID are set up well. Those who are scrambling right now and rolling out tools or systems that may be clunky or inefficient risk losing a portion of their market share, just not having that stood up. The other side to telehealth, I know, you know, in addition to just the E&M type visits, you know, remote patient monitoring and really trying to decant some of your beds and put these patients back in the home and having the infrastructure to do that effectively is also going to surge. So we see both sides of that coin going. But Ryota, I'd love to hear, especially in the orthopedics, I know you deal with this a lot.
Yeah. So one statement I've heard from one of our organizations is that in 3 weeks, they've moved up innovation by 5 years.
Yeah, for telehealth. I believe that.
And that's probably a story we're seeing in many places. In orthopedics in particular, it's been a service line, understandably, that has been a little bit more reluctant to go virtual. A lot of the care requires hands-on manipulation. But given the current environment, they've been really challenged to think what can really be seen virtually, and having a lot more of an open mind to it, I think has been a really big accelerator and one that's going to likely stay. Now, beyond just kind of that physician visit component, and Brian touched on this remote monitoring, really thinking through what care needs to actually be seen in person, what follow-ups need to be in person post-surgery, I think that is really going to be challenged and changed to one that's more evidence-based. There are certainly groups, even before the COVID-19 pandemic, that was pushing for the necessity and frequency of even physical therapy follow-ups.
Right.
I think this will just accelerate that movement even further, which also gives you a chance to free up these resources to be deployed elsewhere, maybe more on the initial evaluation side rather than the follow-up side.
So I would agree. We're definitely going to be seeing a continued acceleration of this virtual platform. You know, one thing that hasn't been mentioned much is that of the independent practitioner. Any thoughts behind the effects on them?
Yeah, this is becoming a real challenge. And Tom, I know you probably have friends, colleagues who are independent. We work with family members. And what we're hearing is if you're not a frontline independent physician, you're probably sitting around wondering when are your patients going to start showing back up. And just the impact financially to the practices has been very tremendous. So we're seeing, you know, systems try to support the independents through a myriad of ways. One is helping them navigate all the new small business loans, other access to funding that may help keep the practice afloat, and just being a centralized hub for distilling knowledge, linking them to state, county, federal resources that might be useful. But the long-term play is really, can these independent providers survive? And if not, are the systems going to have enough capital and cash on hand to actually employ them and bring them in? And if not, where do they go then? And that's where it starts to get more interesting with the world's Optum, other health provider, physician employment type vehicles out there. So that's what we're trying to track. What is the true impact here? We'd like to see the physicians remain as independent and whole as possible. And if not, what's the best alignment vehicle for them to sustain and survive for the long term?
Thank you both for giving us ideas that we can use not only in the days, but in the weeks ahead. And for those listening today, I hope this has helped you look ahead into financial and operational challenges that you may be facing during this crisis. And please join us for other podcasts on the Vizient Medical Leadership Channel. I'm Dr. Tom Villanueva. Thank you so much for listening.